People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And I'm very excited about this play that's opened at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay, Equus, the play written by Peter Schaeffer in 1973, a famous play certainly telling the story of a psychiatrist who attempts to treat a young man who has a pathological religious fascination with horses. And Schaeffer was inspired to write Equus when he heard of a crime involving a 17-year-old who blinded 6 horses in a small town near Suffolk. He set out to construct a fictional account of what might have caused the incident without knowing any of the details of the crime, and the play's action is something of a detective story involving the attempts of the child psychiatrist Dr. Martin Dysart to understand the cause of the boy's actions while wrestling with his own sense of purpose. And playing the role of the psychiatrist, Dr. Dysart, is Graham Hopkins, who is with me in the studio. And Graham has, among a host of successful film, television, radio and theatre performances, memorable roles including Cecil John Rhodes in the SABC series Barney Bonato, for which he won a Star Tonight Best TV Actor Award, Bruce in the South African film The Native, who caused all the trouble, for which he won a Vita Award, Henry Higgins in the 1990 State Theatre production of My Fair Lady, for which he won a Delro Award. He's also done some Goons, which we'll talk about as well. And in addition to a busy professional life, he is a scriptwriter and partner in a very successful event and communications company called 360 Degrees. We'll get to that later. But Graham, welcome. Welcome to People of Note.
Thank you, Rodney. It's good to be here.
This is a fascinating play, I'm sure you'll agree. Have you ever played in it before?
I haven't. It's one of my bucket list roles, so I'm delighted to be doing it. Thank you, Peter Turin.
Okay. And the role of the psychiatrist is really quite it's an intriguing role because it covers so many emotions, doesn't it? Tell me a little bit about Dr. Dysart.
It's a very interesting role because it raises a lot of questions which I think are as valid today as they were in the 1970s. I'm sure that psychiatry has evolved somewhat in the last 40 years, not as much as we like to think. And right. One of the questions that the play raises is, what do we mean by normal? What is the normal? And should we be pursuing it as avidly as we do? I think that the world has become more tolerant than it was in the 1970s. Certainly things like sexual and gender identity, the world is more tolerant of those things than they were in the 1970s. But raising this question of what do we mean by normal? And that the play does very adroitly.
Mm-hmm. And the actual psychiatrist himself seems to me, as I mentioned in this little thing, he seems to have his own problems, shall we say. Is that true in dealing with, certainly with this particular case?
He finds himself in a dead-end marriage in a provincial psychiatric hospital treating children. And yes, he has helped a lot of children. He helps a lot of children. But one of the questions he asks himself is, am I really helping them? Or am I cutting from them parts of individuality? That's the central idea behind Dysart's dilemma, is he recognizes that this boy's behavior is abnormal, that his attractions, that his fascinations are abnormal. But that does raise the question, what is normal?
True. Okay. But then what this boy did, gouging out the eyes of these horses, they talk about, apart from that being the hideous crime it is, they also speak about his sort of fetish, really, with horse hair and skin. So there is a sexual element to it as well.
A fetish element. Very definitely a sexual element to it as well. Look, the crime itself was appalling. And as the magistrate at the beginning of the play says, everybody's going to be shocked by it and disgusted by it. And certainly that's one point of view. Now, we look at the sort of crimes that happen on a daily basis all over the world, and we're shocked by them. But we don't often try to examine the reasons that brought these people to commit these crimes. And sometimes those reasons are legitimate, and it's quite interesting to trace them and to not exonerate them, but to understand where they came from. Mm-hmm. And that's what the play attempts to do. And it's a fascinating journey. It's a fascinating story. I've seen this play many times. They did make a movie of it. It's Richard Burton, I think, playing Dysart. I think that the play is far better suited to the stage because it is truly theatrical. It asks the audience to travel that journey with the storytellers. Mm-hmm. And it's, the theatrical devices that it uses, using human beings to embody the horses, is a very interesting one because it takes the audience to a point where we can begin to sort of understand how this young man has found himself in this situation.
I remember one of the things I remember from early productions I saw of Equus is this horse thing, the humans with those wire heads and the way they have to use their feet to stamp. You know, we've been through the whole war horse phase, but somehow this for me is somehow more real, more eerie even, these wire heads and the curious, ominous stamping that the actors do.
The design is by Marcel Mayer, and he hasn't used wire heads. He's used different materials. But the interesting thing about it is that the horses are still played by human beings. It's the human form. So we as an audience can see the human form and thereby be taken part of the journey towards understanding what Alan Strang feels for the horses. That's key to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the fact that horses are being displayed or being depicted by humans, I think also gives it a kind of a much more human understanding. I remember thinking, I'm glad there wasn't a horse on the stage. I know that might sound ridiculous, but the fact that the humans are moving the way they're instructed to somehow draws you in, don't you agree?
Absolutely. That's why I think that it works much better as a play
than
as a film, because in a film, obviously, you need to use horses. Mm-hmm. So using the human form to take the audience to that point where they can understand what Alan is feeling is the great theatrical device of the play. And that's why it works so well on stage.
I know we don't want to give anything away because, as I said, it's a little bit of a thriller in a sense. When I, for example, can't remember how it ends. I can't remember because it's years since I saw it. But just to sort of give some sort of perspective, is Alan's problem solved in a sense by the psychiatrist? Or would that be giving too much away?
The psychiatrist unravels, traces the history of the problem, understands how this terrible crime has come to be committed, and the audience begins to understand that as well. And I think that that's a very positive and humanizing thing mm-hmm. for the boy. We cannot leave the theater condemning him outright.
Okay.
We have to go some way towards understanding what precipitated this crime, which at face value, of course, we're going to condemn.
Okay, fair enough. Right, well, let's just pause for a moment, Graham, and have a piece of music, your first choice. What have you decided to share with us?
Noel Coward's Alice Is At It Again from the Las Vegas recording.
Okay, and a reason for that?
I was introduced to Noel Coward through an album of the Las Vegas recording with arrangements by Peter Matz, I think it was, and the lyrics, as you will hear, are still wonderfully, wonderfully witty. And I laughed out loud when I heard them. And
let's have a listen, as they say.
In a dear little village, remote and obscure, a beautiful maiden resided. As to whether or not her intentions were pure, opinion was sharply divided. She loved to lie out neath the darkening sky and allow the soft breeze to entrance her. She whispered her dreams to the birds flying by, but seldom received any answer. Over the field and along the lane, gentle Alice would love to stray. When it came to the end of the day, she would wander away, unheeding. Dreaming her innocent dreams, she strolled, quite unaffected by heat or cold. Frequently freckled or soaked with rain, Alice was out in the lane, whom she met there every day. There was a question answered by none, but she'd get there and she'd stay there till whatever she did was undoubtedly done. Over the field and along the lane, both her parents would call in vain. Sadly, sorrowfully, they'd complain, Alice is at it again. Though that dear little village surrounded by trees had neither a school nor a college, gentle Alice acquired from the birds and the bees some exceedingly practical knowledge. The curious secrets that nature revealed she refused to allow to upset her. But she thought, when observing the beasts of the field, that things might have been organized better. Over the field and along the lane, gentle Alice would make up and take up her stand. The road was not exactly arterial, but it led to a town nearby, where quite a lot of masculine material caught her roving eye. She was ready to hitchhike, Cadillac, a motorbike. She wasn't proud or choosy. All she was aiming to be was a minked-up, prinked-up, fly-by-night floozy. When old Rogers gave her pearls as large as nuts on a chestnut tree, all she'd say was fiddle-dee-dee, the wages of sin will be the death of me. Over the field and along the lane, gentle Alice's parents would wait hand in hand. Her dear old white-headed mother, wistfully sipping champagne, said, we've spoiled our child, spared the rod, open up the caviar and say, thank God, we've got no cause to complain. Alice is at it again.
The inimitable Noel Coward, Alice is at it again. And I, for some reason, Graham Hopkins is my guest today, and for some reason, and we were just talking through that piece of music, I'm sure I've seen you do Noel Coward before, because it would suit you so well, but you said you never have.
I never have. I would love to have done Noel Coward, but I never have. Okay. I love those lyrics. Poor dear white-headed mother, wistfully sipping champagne, said, we've spoiled our child, spared the rod. Open up the caviar and say, thank God, we've got no cause to complain. Alice is at it again.
Almost shades of good old William Schwenk Gilbert there with that crisp sort of delivery. But unfortunately, or fortunately, we're talking about a much more serious affair, and that is the play Equus by Peter Schaeffer, which has just opened at the Theatre on the Bay in a production by Fred Abrams, sir. And I should think, Graham, working with Fred on something like this must be both challenging, stimulating and rewarding.
Very much so. First time I've actually worked with Fred as a director, and I'm enjoying it immensely. And it's a challenging piece. Certainly is a very challenging piece.
Graham, it's not a large cast, is it? It's not a huge cast. I know there are the horse people, but the spoken parts is not that great.
By modern standards, it is quite a large cast.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
okay.
There's Alan's mother and his father. There's the stable owner. There's the girl, Jill, who introduces him to the stables, the horses. And there's the psychiatrist.
Okay, so it's hardly
a magistrate who brings the case to the psychiatrist. So it's quite a large cast by modern straight play standards.
Mm-hmm. And the role of Alan, I should think, it has to be played by a young man, but it must also be a fairly grueling thing. And I know Sven is not here to talk about it, but you've worked with him, and I saw him briefly the other day when he came for an interview. He's not done it before, but it must be fairly psychologically and emotionally grueling for a young man to go through this every evening.
It is, I think. Sven does it incredibly well. He has immersed himself in the character, and he flies. He genuinely flies. I would recommend anybody to come to the theatre to see him, if only to see Sven's performance. It's superb.
You're not putting yourself down, of course, Graham.
No, of course not. Of course not. I'm there right beside him.
But just a while ago, we were talking about this sort of sexual atmosphere of this heinous crime that he did, and the fetish thing for horses. But this girl, there's also a sexual interest there, isn't there? Or is there, with a stable girl?
Yes, I don't want to give too much away.
No, fair enough. But, we mustn't. Fair enough.
But yes, there is. And there's an examination of the sexuality of the boy and how the sexuality and the religious fascination are tied up together.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, a reality. Yeah. We sometimes, ritual, religion, sexuality are often tied up with each other.
Right. I was reading a review, Graham, of the play when Daniel Radcliffe famously did it with Richard Griffiths. And the reviewer from The Guardian said something I thought was quite strange. He said that what disturbs me 34 years after the play's premiere is the way Schaffer, the writer, doesn't so much load the dice as overload Dysart, the psychiatrist. Schaffer makes his shrink a sexless Hellenistic whose love of the pagan is purely cerebral. And you're playing that role. What would you have said if someone said that about your performance?
I don't think that Dysart is sexless at all. I think that part of Dysart's dilemma is that he sees the profound sexual passion, the profound passion that this boy feels, and wonders at it, and knows that he is going to take it away. Mm-hmm. And wonders at the morality of doing so. So, yes, I mean, Richard Griffiths played it, and I imagine he would have played it in a kind of sexless way.
Yes.
I don't think that Dysart is by any means sexless. I think that he is caught in that dilemma of understanding the boy's passion and questioning the morality of removing it.
Yes.
That's in order to make the boy normal.
Exactly, as you were saying earlier, he's now removing a passion from this boy, and you're using inverted commas there with your hands to make him normal. And so, as we said, what is normal? But you mentioned Richard Griffiths, and I can't actually imagine him playing. I think of Richard Griffiths as a comedian. And when you think of some of the other people who've played, Richard Burton, I think it's been played as well by people like Anthony Hopkins. These are, well, serious actors, and I can't get my head around the fact that Richard Griffiths, I know I saw him in The History Boys and all that, but what do you think he would have made of the role?
I think he would have done it very well. I mean, it was, the late Richard Griffiths, an extraordinary actor, and the intellectual depth would all have been there. I think just his physical size and persona would have made him, you know, probably what prompted that reviewer to call him sexless.
Sexless Hellenist, which is quite an insult, really, isn't it?
Well, Dysart is a greatly fascinated with ancient Greece and the primitive world and the intuitive truths that perhaps have been lost with Western civilization.
Mm. Yes, because earlier as well, when you said about psychology progressing, I mean, we're all human. We always have been human. And there is always this striving to be normal amongst most of us.
I think we know that any abnormality is just a normal human trait which has been overly exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't claim to be qualified psychologist, but you know, we've all felt a little bit down in the dumps sometimes. We've never been clinically depressed, perhaps, but we all understand that an over exaggeration of feeling down is depression, mm-hmm. and so on. And I imagine that most clinical psychiatry is just an exaggeration of the normality.
Okay. Gosh, we'll have you as a genuine psychiatrist next, Graham. But let's have your next choice of music. What have you chosen for us this time?
Well, I've chosen the second movement of Beethoven's Fifth. The first movement, so well known and wonderfully dramatic and often played on classic radio programs. We don't often hear the second movement, which has a wonderful theme and is equally dramatic and wonderful. So that's the one I chose.
Thank you.
or the second movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And I'm so glad you chose that because, as you say, the opening of that symphony is so important and so famous that one seldom gets to really, I want to say, wallow or relax, which you need because of all the drama that's going to come in the third and fourth movements.
There's a little bit of a lull after the storm of the first movement,
exactly,
that's right.
Yes. Okay, my guest is Graham Hopkins, and we're talking about the play Echoes, which has just opened at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay, directed by Fred Abramser, and starring Graham Hopkins as the psychiatrist. And Sven, I can't quite get his surname right.
Rijkrok. It's a Dutch surname, yes.
Okay, as the young man, Alan. But when I introduced you, Graham, just to move away from Equus for a moment, I spoke about a number of film, television, radio, and theatre performances, and it seems to me as though you've done a sort of equal amount. I associate you mostly with the stage, but you've certainly done your fair share of films, haven't you? Like we mentioned, the Barney Bonato one.
I have done. I tend to associate myself mostly with the stage as well because I enjoy it. Particularly enjoy it. And in fact, since 1983, there hasn't been a year that's gone by when I haven't done at least one.
Oh, really? That's good going.
Yes. And so, I've been very lucky.
And the film thing, because you've done some films for which you won awards. Do you enjoy the whole film?
Oh, I do. I've just finished Showmax series called The Girl from St. Agnes. I was playing the headmaster of a girls' school set in the Natal Midlands, and we filmed in Ikopo.
Oh, right.
And that was fascinating, wonderful, wonderful project.
Near your place of birth, because weren't you born in Pietermaritzburg?
I was born in Pietermaritzburg.
Hilton Courage, that sort of green, wonderful, rolling Natal Midlands area.
Yes,
so it
right.
must have felt quite good working there again.
It was lovely.
And the television side as well, because we see you on television as well.
Well, yes, that Showmax series is a television series,
of course,
yes.
It is.
And I do it whenever I can.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned also in the introduction the word goon show, and I was very intrigued because I'm one of those goon nerds. I was brought up in the early days when the SABC used to play the goon show on a Sunday night and always used to listen and became a huge fan of the goons. And I thought, no, how can they possibly do that? How can Michael Richard be Harry Secombe? How can Graham Hopkins be Peter Sellers? And who played Spike Milligan?
Malcolm Terry. Well, it was an interesting experience because we all felt that as well. You know, how dare we?
Yes.
But Roy
Smiles.
Were you a
Goon fan?
Very much so.
Oh, okay.
Very much
okay.
so. Roy Smiles wrote a play about Spike Milligan is in the mental hospital, and Roy Smiles tells his story in the style of the Goons, bringing in Peter Sellers and Harry Secombe.
Oh, is that how it is?
So that's how the play works.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have latitude to be other actors and to use some of those voices and some of the madness that was the Goons. Very clever play, very clever script, and it did very, very well.
What I'm interested to know is how did the director, which was Alan Swerdlow, wasn't it?
Or that's
who,
right.
Who chose which of the actors was going to play which role? And it was a very good choice because Michael Richard certainly couldn't have played Spike Milligan, and Malcolm Terry couldn't have played Harry Secombe, and no one could have played Peter Sellers, possibly except you.
Well, no. Look, the playing Peter Sellers is, you know, those are huge shoes to fill. So, you know, one did one's best. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really, I wasn't being Peter Sellers. I was giving an impression of Peter Sellers. That's what we were doing.
Right.
All of us were doing. But Michael really did look like Harry Secombe.
He did.
He was remarkable.
I missed it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it was not wanting to see it because I was scared of it being sort of ruined for me. But by all accounts, it was hugely successful, which brings me to the thing, you clearly have a comic streak in you as well. And do you enjoy comedy?
Very much so. Very much so. Look, I enjoy it all. The different challenges,
mm-hmm.
And so one takes each project in turn and
yes.
applies one's mind to the challenge, the particular challenge of the moment.
Well, that's a very professional answer, you know. But we have seen in all sorts of things a musical. You must have enjoyed. Everyone wants to play Henry Higgins.
Yes, wonderful. It's a wonderful role to do. Wonderful role to do because, you know, as an actor who can sing a bit, I'm no singer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful role because, as you know, the music was written around Rex Harrison, and he didn't really sing at all. So the orchestra carries a melody.
Yes.
And
yes.
the timing, for that matter. So you can yes. push and pull the timing and sing when you want to and talk when you don't want to. So it's a fabulous role to do.
It's
and you get to stand role. On a stage with a full orchestra lifting you up into the clouds.
That sounds wonderful. But what a role that is as well. And how, like with Peter Sellers' Big Shoes to Fill, you say, I just feel sorry for actors who have to do Henry Higgins because of Rex Harrison. Do you actually copy him, or do you try and be completely different?
No, I didn't copy him at all. In fact, I sang the role much more than he ever did. People remarked on that.
Mm-hmm.
But they're actually lovely melodies.
Of course they are. It's my favorite musical, may I say. Mm-hmm. And then the voices of Peter Sellers, who famously had this flexible voice box, extraordinary ability to mimic people. Did you do a number of his
Without
characters?
Blowing my own trumpet, I think I'm a reasonably good mimic, particularly behind a microphone. So I know that the commercial voice market has used me a number of times to...
We wouldn't have recognized you.
Yeah, precisely,
okay.
to mimic other voices. And so I had a jolly good crack at it. Mm-hmm. I am sure that the dyed-in-the-wool Goons fans would say, nope, doesn't pass muster. But I did my best.
Okay. Graham, let's have another choice of your music section. I'm becoming more and more intrigued what you're going to come up with next time.
Well, I've chosen quite a variety, as you can see. But the next one is Mr. Sandman by the Cordettes, 1954. So I was born in 56. As a lot of people you will probably remember, we had huge, big Imboya gramophone cabinet.
Yes, a radiogram.
Radiogram, that's yes. right, with the linen fold with ball and claw legs.
Yes, yes.
And in it was a limited selection of records. And so this is my parents' era. And this one's ready for my mother, who will be 90 in May.
Oh, congratulations
Thank
to
you.
Mrs. Hopkins.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Bum, 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 bum.
Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
Bum, 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 bum.
Give him two lips like roses and clover.
Bum, 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 bum.
Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone.
Bum, 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 bum.
Don't have nobody to call my own.
Bum, 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 bum.
Please turn on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen. Give him the word that I'm not a rover. Then tell him that his lonesome nights are over. Sandman, I'm so alone. Don't have nobody to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam. Oh, Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Bum, 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 bum.
Mr. Sandman.
Yes?
Bring us a dream. Give him a pair of eyes with a come-hither gleam. Give him a lonely heart like Pagliacci. And lots of wavy hair like Liberace. Mr. Sandman, someone to hold.
Someone to hold.
Would be so peachy before we on your magic beam. Mr. Sandman, bring us, please, 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 Mr. Sandman, bring us a dream.
I haven't heard that for a number of years, Graham. Mr. Sandman, who was performing it?
The Cordettes.
The Cordettes, gosh. That's a bit of nostalgia from you. As you say, congratulating your mother on her 90th birthday coming up in May. Graham Hopkins is my guest. And one of the reasons you're here, Graham, is obviously to talk about the play, the Peter Schaeffer play, Echoes, which has just opened at the Theatre on the Bay. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But in all the things you do, I notice that there are things that you do that not necessarily on the stage as much as you like being on the stage, because you had a company I mentioned earlier, a sort of communication event company. But you also do script writing, don't you, and training, all sorts of things. Tell me about what you do when you're not treading the boards.
Well, I started my life as a school teacher. I was a mathematics teacher in Pietermaritzburg, and in fact, somebody whose music you performances you play on FMR reasonably often, Christopher Daigan.
Yes.
We'll remember being taught Standard 6 mathematics by me.
Oh, really?
Alexandra High School in Pietermaritzburg.
I shall talk to him about that immediately.
But I wasn't a maths teacher for long. I never intended to stay in that profession, and I moved into the acting profession. But I have found, well, certainly for the first decade or so, I used to earn my living exclusively from commercial voiceovers and acting. Then when my son was born, I realized that I needed to find other strings to the bow. And so I started doing other things. And I used my teaching training. So I have worked as an executive trainer. I've done works for mining companies and for the financial services industry. And I find that very interesting because it's really just teaching at another level. I've done script writing for the corporate world, big conferences and so on. And, of course, that's a good additional income stream.
Of course, from the commercial world indeed, not from the theatrical world. But with your script writing, have you ever written a play, or is it mostly just, script writing for events?
In the early days, when I was working at PACT, we did a couple of things. My good friend Martin Lemaitre and I wrote a play called Your Indoor Garden, which is long since lost. I don't think we could even find it again, but it was an interesting experience. I was at one stage a card-carrying member of the End Conscription campaign, and I wrote a play, compiled a play, I think, is probably the better description, based on the experience of David Bester, who was jailed for 6 years, David Bruce and Charles Bester, both of whom around the same time were convicted. It was a mandatory 6-year sentence in those days. And so I've done a little bit of that, but most of my script writing has been for the commercial market.
Okay. And then the other big question is, and I'm interested to see how you're going to answer this, directing? Have you never had the urge to direct?
I've deliberately chosen not to because I like being on stage. I like performing. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes when you're directing, you know, you can't be on stage. You have to be off it. I like to participate. And, you know, I've worked an enormous amount with my good friend Alan Swerdlow. And he and I have a very good consultative relationship. He'll tell me if he thinks I'm talking nonsense. But I offer suggestions and participate in the process. But no, I prefer to perform.
To be on stage. Mm. And this working with various directors, it must be quite a thing, because especially a play as intense as Equus, I should think, you need to rely very heavily on the director, and there needs to be mutual respect, and you need to be on the same page, to use a sort of a cliche.
Absolutely, and I'm really enjoying working with Fred Abramser, who has a very clear vision for the play and a very good handle on it. So I think we're in very safe hands.
But just to take a step or two back, how did you end up in teaching? Or when you grew up, did you not really know what you wanted to do?
like most people, let's face it, most people. My father was a general practitioner in Pietermaritzburg, very big practice and very well loved. And he led me to believe that being a family doctor would be a good thing because of all his stories, which were very much sort of human stories. And so I ended up here in Cape Town at UCT in first year medical school. And I realized really after a couple of months that really I wasn't cut out to be a doctor. Mm-hmm. So I had to make a very difficult phone call to my dad. And bless him, he absolutely understood. He said, it's your life, and I can see that you're probably not really cut out to be a doctor. But he said, if you're going to go and study drama and all this nonsense, for heaven's sake, study something saleable. How about doing mathematics as part of your degree, your arts degree? So I did. I had something to fall back on. Mm. And of course, when you have something to fall back on, you invariably fall back on it, which I did for a bit. But I was determined not to stay there.
Okay. So the drama thing had already reared its head, that you were thinking already of perhaps going into the world of theater.
Yes, and everybody,
even as a math teacher.
And everybody was discouraging me. You know, you can't make a living out of the theater.
Yes. Well, look what's happened to you.
Yes, look at me now.
So you look at you now. We're going to have another piece of music now, Graham, and what will that be?
I've chosen You're 16 by Ringo Starr.
Good heavens. Why?
Well, I was 17 when this came out, and I just remember it very clearly from then.
So maybe next time we have an interview together, you'll choose when I'm 64.
Yes, perhaps. But not quite there yet.
Okay. Let's listen to Ringo Starr.
Come on like a dream, peaches and green, lips like strawberry wine. You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine, all mine. You're all ribbons and curls, who what a girl, eyes that sparkle and shine. You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine. You're my baby, you're my pet. We fell in love on the night we met. You touched my hand, my heart went pop. Ooh, when we kissed, I could not stop. You walked out of my dream, into my arms. Now you're my angel divine. You're 16, you're beautiful.
That's Ringo Starr, a choice of my guest, Graham Hopkins. Was that when he was still part of the Beatles, or was he on his own?
It was after the Beatles, really, and all the other ones were much more famous, really, than Ringo. But he produced this album, and it was very good.
I believe he's a very nice person, Ringo Starr.
I believe so.
Yeah. And, you know, Paul McCartney and John Lennon, all that, the famous ones. But he apparently was a very nice, ordinary guy, so to speak. You've demonstrated quite a lot of different tastes in music. Is music important to you, Graham? Do you enjoy music?
I enjoy listening to music. I'm not any kind of guru, really. I know what I like. And I have pieces, really, that are associated with certain times in my life, as I think all people do. Mm-hmm. Music is very evocative in that way. It takes you right back to when you first heard them.
And when you are relaxing away from the stage, would you put on a... You mentioned Beethoven's Fifth Symphony earlier. Would you put on a piece of classical music, a symphony or concerto?
I often listen to Richard Koch's The Full Works, I enjoy.
Yes.
And when I'm in the car, that's my choice of radio station.
Talking about cars, I remember when I interviewed you once before, we ended up talking about one of your passions, and we can't talk about it in too much detail now, but I know that you absolutely are passionate about collecting old cars.
Yes. I've owned a lot of very, very interesting old cars. I mean, I say old cars because I don't buy new cars. As an actor, it's not prudent to do that. But I've owned some really, really interesting cars. And my pride and joy, which I've had for a long time now, is a 1973 Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow 1.
Oh,
beautiful,
no.
Beautiful, beautiful car.
I want one.
And I've taken many friends... children to their matric dances and so on. My own son, I chauffeured him to his matric dance.
Oh, excellent.
And
But does this mean, Graham, that you can tinker with them and fix them? Because don't you need if it's an old lady?
I'm not a mechanic. I'm not mechanically minded. So it's looked after by the heritage dealers in Johannesburg, PL Motors, and before that was Grosvenor Motors. And I've got a service history that goes way back into the 1970s.
And do you use it a lot, or is it just there for ceremonial occasions?
I definitely use it at least once a week, because that's the key with old cars. Don't leave them on blocks, because everything dries out, all the seals dry out, and you know it'll deteriorate if you do that. Cars need to be used. And so I do. I take it out.
And is a Rolls... Which Rolls Royce is it?
It's the Shadow One.
The Shadow. Mm. Is it very heavy on petrol? Is it a guzzler?
I'm afraid so. So I have to save up to fill up petrol, but I don't use it often or long distances.
It's a great lifelong wish of mine to have a Rolls Royce and float around.
Well, next time you're in Johannesburg, give me a ring. Okay. And
will you take me for a
ride?
I'll
take you for a ride.
Okay. You can take me for dinner and wait outside.
Yes, you can sit in the back and wave.
Yes, exactly. But we also spoke about music just now, and it suddenly dawned on me, if I remember correctly, Equus has music, doesn't it? It has rather haunting... What is the situation with this production?
This production has music specially composed by Charles Johann Lingenfelder, and very atmospheric underscoring to some of the parts of the play, which I think enhances it enormously.
And I was also thinking, what about the actual look of the play? Is it a busy set? Is the lighting clever? Because it's such a haunting story, really. That atmosphere, I'm sure, has a lot to do with it.
The essence of the story is that you're in a psychiatrist's consulting rooms and you're taken on an imaginative journey. So it's representational in that sort of way. There's certainly not a realistic set, and you are asked to go on that imaginative journey with the actors. True storytelling. True imaginative storytelling.
Right at the beginning of the interview, Graham, you said that this was one of your bucket list roles, the psychiatrist in Equus. Has it proved to be
challenging? It's a challenging role. It's full of intellectual concepts which he grapples with, emotional state that he goes through himself, that he has to guide the boy through. It's a very intense play, and I think it in an intense experience for an audience to watch as well.
Which is, I think, part of the joy of it. I remember coming out of the theatre actually feeling quite kind of exhausted, but in a positive way.
I don't think that you can watch it passively at all, no.
And you have lots to say as a psychiatrist. How do you learn your lines? It always fascinates me with actors, how they learn their lines.
I always used to say in response to that question, that's like asking a concert pianist how they learn the sequence of notes. It's not really what the thing is about. Right. But it is a chore, and you have to learn how to do it. And we all have different ways of doing it. I have my own ways.
Okay.
And
which you're clearly not going to share with us.
No, I certainly can. I think a lot in images. Mm-hmm. Some people photograph the page in their minds and they're reading it in their minds. I can't do that. I do initially do that, but I need to move away from that and to tie it into the geography of the stage and the imaginative world that we're involved in. Mm-hmm. So in the same way that you might tell a story, if you're telling a story, you're imagining the images of that story as you're telling them. You go on that journey. The journey that hopefully the audience will go on with you. You need to think those things. That's how you tell them. That's how you remember the words.
Okay. Now that makes sense. Thank you for sharing one of your tools of your trade with us. But we've more or less run out of time, Graham, but certainly you've made it seem as though this play is something to behold. And I know it is, having seen it before, so I can't wait. I haven't seen it yet, but I can't wait. So thanks for coming along and chatting to us, Graham Hopkins.
Thank you.
Who plays the role of Dr. Martin Dysart in Equus, which is playing now at the Theatre on the Bay here in Cape Town, Peter Tureen's Theatre on the Bay. But you're allowed to have one more choice of music.
All right, thank you.
Then your going off stage music.
My going off stage music is Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John.
Ah.
It was my matric year. And
you know that he's just turned 72.
Has he?
I think just a few days ago he turned 72. Okay, well, let's go on the Yellow Brick Road. And Graham Hopkins, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Should have listened to my own mind. You need- sign up for you. I'm not a present for your friends to open. This boy's too young to be singing the blues.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This March, Peter Turin presents Peter Schaffer's internationally acclaimed hit play, Equus. Starring Graham Hopkins and Sven Reichrock, with direction by Fred Abramser and movement by Mark Goldberg. For those who loved it, for those who missed it, catch this multi-award-winning play from the 29th of March until the 20th of April. That's Equus. Only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now.
FMR.